Today is December 10th, 2009. We're at the Amelia Island Museum of History, 233 South 3rd Street in Fernandina Beach, Florida. The following interview is being conducted as part of the Amelia Island Museum of History's Veterans History Project in partnership with the Library of Congress. Today we have the honor and privilege of interviewing Dr. Joel Miles Carter. Dr. Carter was born on January 31st, 1938, in Seattle, Washington. My name is Don Hill, and I will interview the Dr. Carter on behalf of the Amelia Island Museum of History. According to your bio sheet here, Joel, you joined the Air Force when you were 17 years old. And I'm curious, for the purpose of the interview, where were you, what were you doing, what were you thinking, and how did you choose and why did you choose the Air Force?
Well, first of all, I had just become orphaned. My parents died during the previous year. My mother died July 20th of 1954. My father died January 20th, 55, exactly 6 months to the day. I turned 17 on January 31st and joined the Air Force on March the 3rd. I specifically joined because I had dropped out of high school in the 10th grade. And I got caught by the local authorities with my third speeding ticket, and I got caught living alone. I had no guardian, I had no parents, I had nothing. And I was living in the house that I was raised in, little knowing that there was an unpaid mortgage on the house. And I soon learned that the carpenters who were renovating the upstairs of the house were doing so at the behest of the mortgage holder, who was, as gently as he could, trying to repossess or foreclose on the house, but was just hoping that some disposition would be made with respect to my residence there. And it happened. As I said, I got caught. And I was given the choice of joining the service or going to an orphanage.
By federal authority, I mean by the judge or somebody like that, or was it
local
family protection?
Juvenile authorities, you know.
And right.
As a matter of fact, my brother-in-law was a county probation officer, and somehow or another he became involved. I don't know whether that was for my benefit or what, but he personally took my driver's license from me, which to a 16-year-old was like a death sentence, you know. And so I just said, well, I'll show them. I'll just join the service. I picked the Air Force simply because I was not very gung-ho. The Marines and the Army and the Navy seemed a little tough for me, and the Air Force had a reputation for being the more civilized service at the time. The Air Force was only 8 years old. Yes.
Who signed for you, if I may ask?
Well, I was 17, and it was legal.
I thought one had to be 18.
No,
17.
17. And nowadays, you have to have a high school education. Back then, you
exactly,
didn't.
Exactly, right.
So I joined with a 10th grade education on March the 3rd, like I said, which was just a little over a month past my 17th birthday. And so I chose the Air Force, like I said, because I felt that it would be the easiest of the services. And the draft was still, that's another thing, the draft was still in effect then. So in order to avoid the draft, I felt I'd better be making my own choices while I could.
Sure.
And so I did.
Where did you go to boot camp?
Parks Air Force Base, California.
In California.
Just outside of Hayward, California.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it exists any longer. But
was that an 8 or 10 week period, do you recall?
I think it was about 12, something
12
like
weeks
that.
Back
yeah.
then?
Yeah. Yeah. I enjoyed it. I mean, I had some experiences in basic training which reflected how I was brought. I was very well loved and very well cared for. In other words, I can't sit here and tell you I came from, you know, a dysfunctional family or anything like that.
Sure.
And then suddenly I was orphaned. So I went, you know, from a coddled, spoiled little brat into a homeless person. So the Air Force provided me with some structure, you might say.
Sure.
And which I had a little hard time getting, like being awakened suddenly and violently by the rattling of a garbage can by the DI.
And we all went through that, didn't we?
But I liked it because actually I had joined, and this was for the purpose of impressing girls. I had joined the National Guard when I was about 15, 15 and a half, something like that, which nobody seemed to care. And so I learned marching, and so I was made the guide-on. I was picked as the guide-on for our flight, and so I got to march at the head of the...
You set the pace for everybody.
Yes.
That's
yes,
right.
I did. So I that kind of gave me a little swagger. And I enjoyed that.
What was the process? Did you go through then, subsequent to boot camp, a professional training period with the Air Force?
Yes, technical training at Keesler Air Force Base.
Keesler.
Air Traffic Control. I chose that simply because I had an interest, although, again, I was very young, but I had an interest. In aviation, my father had been a dealer, if you will, for small airplanes when I was growing up, and I used to simply hang out at the airport in Seattle, and so I had a childhood interest in flying. Of course, as a young enlisted person, I had no shot at being an Air Force pilot. But air traffic control seemed like a good alternative. So
you must have had good test scores, though, in order to get that. I mean, that's a fairly technical, difficult process, I would think. Mm-hmm. So you maybe had your choice of several different things because of your test score.
I'm sure. And also at the time I took the GED. That's when I got
for your
high school graduation.
Right.
Yeah. So I became an air traffic controller at Keesler. And
how long was that training?
It's hard to remember, but it couldn't have been more than, I finished, if I joined the Air Force in March, June maybe is when I finished, June or July I finished basic, so
right.
It was summer when I got to Keesler, and it was fall when I got out of Keesler.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And your first duty station after the training?
Was LAD Air Force Base, Fairbanks, Alaska. 64 degrees below zero at the time.
Oh, yeah. Was LAD sort of a support of an army facility?
It could have been, but I must tell you, at that time, I really wasn't terribly conscious about the mission or I was
sure.
An air traffic controller. I went to work and I controlled airplanes from the control tower. But there was a nearby army base, the name of which...
Fort Wainwright, I think.
No, well, I was thinking of Eielson Air Force Base, but that's an Air Force Base. There,
right.
Fort Richardson, maybe?
Yes, yeah. I think
there.
That's true up there.
Yeah, so it could have been. And there were large C-124, triple-deck, four-engine transport planes.
Right.
There, so that you may be right about that.
So that was shift work? I mean, you went off, worked the mid-watch and...
Yeah, eight-hour shifts around the clock, yeah.
But not terribly difficult duty. I mean, you weren't eight on or eight off or anything like that. You were
no, that came later, but uh-huh. not during the Air Force. No,
I see.
No, so
was that? I mean, how you must have found that challenging and interesting in order to be involved and have that responsibility.
A
very young age.
Yeah, I thought so. I mean, one can argue that the person who is in control of that airplane is the pilot, and that's true.
Yes.
However, the pilot is. I mean, if we all got up and walked out of the tower, he'd have a hard time getting down. Let's put it that way. There was a certain amount of control and a certain amount of authority, I guess you could say. But the pilot in command is in command at all times. But we separate airplanes from one another. We control the environment, so to speak, the traffic. Well, that's why they call it air traffic control.
Sure,
I guess.
Sure.
We don't control the airplanes. We control the traffic.
Was weather an issue often, I would think, in the winter especially?
When it was 60 below zero and you had ice fog through which it was hard enough to walk, much less see.
Sure.
Through it. So, but again, I was 17 years old. I was very resilient.
Loved every minute of it.
Yeah. Yes, it was very, very cold. But I must say, the Air Force dressed us extremely well. There was no, just actually, there, unless you pulled back the hood of your parka when you shouldn't have, you know what I mean? Just because if I was afraid of messing up my hair or something like that, then I was at risk for frostbite and things like that, which I got a few times. But if you kept zipped up, buttoned up, and cinched up, there was absolutely no discomfort at all. I mean, you could adjust the hood on your parka to where only your eyes were showing. In other words, your chin and your mouth and your nose could be covered, and your feet and hands, torso, everything. So I really wasn't uncomfortable at all.
What did you do for recreation at LAD?
Well, at LAD, I was only at LAD during that winter. Of course, there wasn't any outdoor recreation at all. Bowling. I took up bowling. And even the passageway to the bowling alley was underground. Everything, all the necessary travels were underground. So the only, I don't even remember marching in the snow. And we had to be outdoors at some point.
Well, sure.
I think going to the mess hall was like maybe two or three doors down. And some guys, including myself at times, would actually run from the barracks to the mess hall without putting on
their gear.
Oh. And that was funny because even though your body stayed warm enough, the material of your fatigues was very cold, and you'd be, you know, picking at your shirt to get it off of your chest.
Sure.
You know? But I was only at LAD, like I said, until the spring of the following year, so just one long winter. And from there I went to ADAC in the Aleutians, and that was a windy experience, as I recall.
That's where you and I went and worked with the Navy guys out there.
And that was simply because, and I understood very little about this, but it was simply because the Air Force was running a temporary project of some kind, and I guess they wanted Air Force controllers in the tower. That doesn't mean that we displaced the Navy controllers. We merely joined them, and I think assumed control of any Air Force plane coming in and left the Navy planes to the Navy controllers. But that was in the spring of 56.
Were you the youngest in your work center, or were there other young men like yourself? And
I was certainly amongst the youngest.
Sure.
But as I recall, especially back in basic training, there were teenage thugs from Los Angeles, you know, gang members, and there were fights all the time. But when I got into air traffic control, I don't really remember too much about the personalities involved. But yes, I was the youngest, or near the youngest the whole time I was in. Yeah.
Did you have any, either on ADAC or at LAD, any stressful situations?
No.
To deal with and you got mature. You matured right away. I mean,
I think so.
Yeah.
Given not only my age, but my childhood, you know. In other words, as I told you, I was coddled and spoiled and protected and sheltered and loved, and suddenly I wasn't so loved anymore in the military. But it's sort of like I expected that, and I could tell that I was growing up. In other words, when I would go home on leave, I would find myself older than or more mature than some of my contemporaries
who had stayed home.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
I found that as well too. How would you compare the facilities and the chow, let's say, between the Navy facilities and the Air Force?
I really don't recall. It's very difficult. I mean, and I was only at ADAC for 2 or 3 months,
uh-huh.
maybe, and I don't recall any differences at all.
Sure.
If anything. Now, I started to say, if anything, the Navy might have been a little more disciplined, but that's because that was their base, and we were guests, so to speak. So we Air Force people probably felt a little looser than the Navy.
Sure. So after that TDY trip to ADAC, what happened next in your Air Force career?
I was then transferred to Elmendorf Air Force Base in Anchorage.
Much bigger than
the
other places you've been.
Yes, and I was there for a couple of years, I guess, from 56, about 2 years I was at Elmendorf. And that's where I took flying lessons and learned how to fly myself at Elmendorf.
And now you're all the way up to 18 or 19 learning how to fly. And
Yes. I suppose that helped my ability to control air traffic, or at least to understand the pilot's position.
Did you get your pilot's license while you were there? Mm-hmm. Oh, great.
Yeah.
That's super.
In 56,
uh-huh.
My license.
Do you still have your pilot's license?
I still have it. However, I'm physically disabled. I'm almost blind.
Uh-huh.
I drive in the daytime. I don't drive at night.
I understand.
In 1998, we can get to that, I guess, but in 1998, I had some health setbacks, which... But up until 1998, I owned my plane, and my wife and I would fly around the country.
Great.
Like that,
Which
all started in Alaska in 1956.
Sure. So you're at Elmendorf for a couple of years. Are you nearing then the end of your Air Force career at that point?
Nearing it. I had a little bit over a year left, which I spent at Mitchell Air Force Base, New York. That was the last assignment.
How do you suppose you wound up all the way back on the East Coast?
I don't know how the selection process works.
Uh-huh.
I know how I got Alaska. Some men were choosing places that were probably quite high on the desirability list, and they would get sent to very undesirable places because too many people wanted to go to Hawaii or something like that. So Thule, Greenland seemed to be the most popular place to send the excess wannabes. And so I thought, now I'm not going to get sent to Greenland. I'm going to choose Alaska, which certainly isn't going to be very high on anybody's priority list, but not as bad as Greenland, see? So by choosing Alaska, I certainly got Alaska. I don't remember even whether I chose New York or not, or what the process was in sending me there. But it was fine with me, right near New York City.
Well, the reason I brought it up, because normally one would think that your assignment folks would know that you're probably going to get out and want to put you closest to your home of record to save the Air Force money.
Yeah, you're right there. No, they had to pay my way all the way across the
back
country.
Back to the West Coast, right.
Yeah.
So, and you air traffic control at that point as well at Mitchell?
Oh, yes. That was my only...
Was the traffic not nearly as... Well, wait a minute. You were in the New York City area. I would think traffic control would have been a serious challenge in that area.
Well, except that the control tower at Mitchell Air Force Base doesn't have to contend with the traffic over New York City.
Uh-huh.
The instrument traffic, you know, airplanes that are flying on instruments are pretty well controlled by the FAA civilian agency in and around New York City. And we at Mitchell would only become involved when the airplane was within 20, 25 miles of Mitchell, which would not include New York City.
Uh-huh.
I mean, we were on Long Island. But yes, we had to coordinate from time to time. But no, we at Mitchell were not involved with the control of air traffic over New York City or anywhere near New York City. And even then, only our own military planes that were coming in. And, you know, each airport, each civilian or military airport for that matter, has a buffer zone around it.
Sure.
And you're supposed to stay out of that if you don't have any business being in it. So as a rule, we were only responsible for military air traffic coming and going for Mitchell. So no, it wasn't hard.
What type of aircraft did you control both at Elmendorf and at Mitchell?
Mm-hmm. At Elmendorf, I recall F-89 fighter jets.
Was that the scorpion, maybe, or something like that?
I think
that?
So. I think so.
Just, I don't know why that jumped out
at me. Well, I hadn't heard that word since I was in it, but I think so. F-89s, yeah. They had huge rocket pods, one on each wingtip, and that was their armament, with rockets.
Right.
And also, of course, there were C-119, Fairchild C-119 cargo planes, C-124s, C-118s. So I would say fighter, it had to have been a fighter base, and with transports coming and going, bringing men and material there. At Mitchell, I remember this B-26, Douglas B-26
sure.
bombers.
Yes.
I don't believe they were serving any purpose as a bomber. I don't know what their purpose was, but I can actually remember the sight of B-26s coming and going quite frequently. And I flew in and out of there. It was kind of comical. I was in the Aero Club. The Air Force used to donate to their bases surplus training planes. And in this case, we're talking about the Beechcraft T-34. Mentor was its name. And as each of these training planes became obsolete, they would donate them, and so I flew. And, of course, you didn't have to leave the base and take off from a nearby civilian airport. You take off and land right at Mitchell.
Sure.
So I would take off, and whenever my comrades in the tower knew that it was me, they pulled this joke, and now I realize because it was Continental Air Command headquarters and because there's always a concern about rank. And so it was very common to ask the pilot of any plane what high rank aboard is in case it's a general or something like that. So when I was up, they would say, Air Force so-and-so, what's high rank aboard? And I said, Airman Second Class. And they knew it was me.
Yeah, exactly.
That was to get the attention of any legitimate Air Force planes that were flying in the area. Airman Second Class.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
We did that all the time. Yeah.
But interestingly enough, by you flying that aircraft,
Yeah. You
literally were in an aircraft that fledgling pilots flew earlier as they worked their way toward a full pilot's license with the Air Force. You know? So you really did step into the – you were on your way at that point.
If you want to call it the T-3, I was at the bottom of the totem pole. But
where did you fly around? I mean, again, New York City to me is just – massive with massive traffic issues.
You have to remember, I did things, as we all have done at that age, that I wouldn't dare do today.
Sure.
But I was a fearless, by then, 20-year-old. And what I did do, to answer your question, I didn't have a commercial pilot's license. I had only a private pilot, so I could not charge people money to fly, but I could accept gas money. So I would fly my buddies home, which was very useful to them, because if you were at Mitchell Air Force Base and say you lived in Philadelphia and you wanted to go home for the weekend, well, Philadelphia is only 92 miles away, but on the other hand, the number of buses, trains, planes, cars that you would have to transfer to would be an all-day affair, whereas I could fly them directly from Mitchell to Philadelphia in 30 minutes, so I would accept gas money. So I flew from Mitchell to various Boston, Syracuse, Philadelphia, places within a couple of hundred miles from Mitchell. And that way I got in my flying without having to, of course, rental of that aircraft was only like $5 an hour.
Yes.
You can't even rent a car for that.
Were there any restrictions on you from the Aero Club on, when you signed out for that aircraft, on where you could go or what you could do?
No, I could fly.
Like anywhere. For a weekend, you could take it Friday and bring it back Sunday, or?
Okay, I never did that, but I think I could.
Could have.
I think there would have to be special permission.
Sure.
And I would probably have to pay a little extra for keeping it overnight, but I never did that.
Understood.
It was always just day trips to and from.
In good weather, you wouldn't go when it was...
I wasn't instrument rated, so
right.
I couldn't fly. I am now, or I have been.
Sure.
But back then, no, I was strictly visual.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That had to be interesting, though, and those guys must have loved it.
Well, yeah, and I got a little... I can remember some instances where I got a little horsey. I remember landing, I think it was Boston, and I taxied up, and there was, I wanted to park next to the, what they call executive air terminal, and there wasn't any space there, and there was a Lodestar, I don't know if you know what that is, a Lockheed Lodestar,
sure.
Twin engine, tail dragger,
right.
10 passengers, was parked right about where I wanted to park, and I stood up, and you could slide the canopy of the T-34 back, and so I could...
It's a tricycle, the T-34?
Yes. Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
Yes, and so I stood up and yelled at the pilot. I can't give you the exact words, but it was something to the effect of, are you about ready to move that thing?
Good for you.
I mean, here I have a little 20-year-old kid in a T-34 yelling at the corporate, I think it was a Continental Can Company airplane.
Sure.
And yelling at him as to... what his intentions were about moving that thing. I can remember saying that, and, to which he responded with an unfriendly glare.
I'm sure of it.
That was about it.
I'm sure of it. You know. So how did things end up at Mitchell, or what were your plans at that point? Was that near the end of your enlistment?
Well, it was the end of my enlistment.
Was there any effort to keep you around to make you a career person?
Oh, no.
Nobody
none,
asked
none
you to
whatsoever.
Stay.
No what?
Nobody asked you to stay, or
no? I had entertained thoughts of becoming an airline pilot, but I didn't have the qualifications. I think I actually filled out a few applications. So then, what I did, and the smart thing, I applied to the FAA for a job immediately following my discharge. So I got out in December of '58. But I was not yet 21, and you have to be 21 to go to work for the FAA. So I will tell you that I went to work with the FAA on my 21st birthday. So on that day, I was the youngest air traffic controller in the FAA. I had to be, because it was
on your
my
birthday.
21st birthday. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, did they send you down to, where's the training facility in Tulsa to?
Well, it's Oklahoma City.
Oh, that's what I meant, Oklahoma City.
But no, I was already trained.
So you had all the quals that you needed in order.
Yes.
Wow, that's great.
I don't recall choosing where I went. I may have. I just don't recall.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, I was started at San Francisco International Airport, and I think... the reason, or one of the reasons for putting me at San Francisco, was that it was a huge facility and they had the wherewithal, the resources to train on the job training for those of us who just needed a little transitional training from the Air Force to the civilian. So that training took place at San Francisco, but it was on the job. There were no classrooms or anything like that. It was strictly come to work. And we did have eight on and eight off.
For a while there.
Well, it started with 2 day shifts, 7 to 3.
Oh, okay.
And then on the night of the second day shift, in other words, after getting off at 3 p.m., I had to come back at 11 p.m.
Right.
And work till 7 a.m. the next day. And then I didn't have to come back until 3 to 11 the following. So on... all three shifts would be worked within a 5-day period.
Sure.
Two of which were only 8 hours apart.
Was that entering that? Well, that was nearing the commercial jet age, but not quite there at the point.
Oh no! I was on duty when the very first commercial jet flew out of San Francisco.
Aha! Uh-huh.
Now, L.A. to New York had perhaps begun a few months earlier, but in fact, I think Pan Am or American Airlines may have had jet service in 1958 while I was still stationed in New York. But as far as San Francisco goes, I was on duty United was last because they ordered the Douglas DC-8 instead of the Boeing 707. And Boeing was way ahead of Douglas. And I remember the very first flight, United 800, from San Francisco to New York was delayed for hours and hours because of little nitpicky mechanical
safety
problems
things that
they had. Yeah, they didn't take off till the afternoon sometime, and it was a morning flight.
Sure. Back to the Air Force for a moment. Are there any unique or interesting characters that stick in your mind, or do you still have any teammates that you communicate with
from
the Air Force?
I would like to, but I can't remember anybody's name.
Sure.
And, And I'm sure many of them are no longer with us.
So, perhaps, yes.
But I remember one fellow who, and it wasn't all this interesting, but it must have been because I still remember it. He was very good at imitating British pilots.
On the microphone, you mean, against...
Oh, no, he wouldn't do that.
Oh, okay.
Just in conversation, he would put on a little act. He would imitate a BOAC, British, you know, it's now British Airways.
Yeah. But,
and their nickname was Speedbird. It would be Speedbird 121 or something like that. And he would do a pretty good imitation of a British accent. And
that's
British,
great.
Yeah. It was fun. We had, at San Francisco, we had a lot of foreign airliners coming in. And although they spoke English because it was mandatory, sometimes their accents were very, very difficult to understand. And I recall the most difficult accent was not really foreign, but it was Southern. Delta Airlines started flying into San Francisco while I was there. And I remember having to ask them to repeat a couple of times. But we had Japan Airlines, Lufthansa.
Probably the Australian airlines.
Qantas.
Qantas, yeah.
I love those guys. They just seem like so, you know, they sounded just like these Outback commercials.
On television. Yeah. They're great. Yeah. So you're out of the Air Force without, I guess, any obligation, or did you stay in the inactive reserves for a while?
Correct.
To get your full 6 years.
Eight years.
I had
an 8 year obligation. But there were no meetings. I did not belong, to my knowledge, I didn't belong to any organized reserve
Understood.
Group at all.
Understood.
And that expired, 1962 or three, something
right.
like that.
Yeah. So you came away from the Air Force, though, with a very, very important skill and profession, being an air traffic controller.
Yes.
Did you stay in that for your...
For a while. I was very young and very impulsive, and I used the Air Force, first of all, just to make a living, because that's the only thing I knew how to do. My dream of being an airline pilot didn't pan out, so I became the air traffic controller. I used it in my dating life. In other words, it was very impressive to the girls that I was an air traffic controller, and I would... Every date that I cared about, I would bring them up to the tower and
nice.
Say, this is where I work.
Sure,
sure. It would be very impressive. But as I said, I was very impulsive. I quit all of a sudden because I can recall men, controllers, who were they seemed ancient to me, but they were probably just in their 40s, you know, and I was in my 20s. I could see them... being affected by the pressure.
The stress.
And these are all older, married, you know, family people. And I was young, single, and had no cares and no responsibilities. And I just one day just asked myself, do I want to end up like this? Because the FAA is the only employer of air traffic controllers. So unless I actually change professions... I'm going to be stuck like them. And so I absolutely didn't want that to happen. So actually, I tried to transfer. I took a vacation from San Francisco back to Tennessee, where my late parents were born, just for the heck of it. And I remember meeting a girl and wanting to transfer to Chattanooga, you know. And the Air Force wouldn't allow you to,
FAA
wouldn't allow you to transfer out of your region. So I said, okay, I'll quit. So I quit and moved to Chattanooga. So that was the end of air traffic control.
Uh-huh.
And I was 24 by then. I was 62.
What happened next?
Well, then's when I actually started going downhill. I moved to Chattanooga, and I just took one job after another. Reading the want ads every day. Because remember, I only had a GED.
Yes, at that point,
so
sure.
I wasn't very qualified for anything. And I tried selling. That didn't work. And even ended up as a... Well, I got married, I should say. About 6 months after I arrived in Chattanooga, I got married. simply because I thought, well, now it's time. You know, you're 24 years old. You should settle down and have a family. Well, I settled down and had a family. I had a wife and two kids, still only a GED, and still. And I was a janitor. I was cleaning out, I was emptying waste cans. I was janitoring at a DuPont nylon plant in Chattanooga. And one of my cleanup stations was the doctor's offices. And I can remember emptying the waste cans and taking home some of their throwaway journals. And I guess you could say it was sort of a perverted erotica, but medical photographs in the journals provided some entertainment, you might
sure.
say. But I tried reading them, but I couldn't even read them. But I was interested. There was something in the back of my mind that was prodding me to read, even though I was a very poor reader. I could barely read. I was pretty much functionally illiterate. And to answer an obvious question, how could I be an air traffic controller? I had an amazing ability to memorize things, even though I didn't have a heck of an idea of what I was memorizing. I could memorize things. So I functioned as an air traffic controller with barely the ability to read. So I started trying to read these medical journals with very little success. Like I said, the pictures in them were of more interest than
sure.
the text.
Right.
But President Lyndon Johnson, in the summer, I believe, of 1966. Now, by then I'm 28, still uneducated. Lyndon Johnson reenacted the GI Bill, which had expired on my 17th birthday, January 31st, 1955. The Korean GI Bill expired. So had I joined the Air Force before midnight that day, you know, I would have had GI benefits, but
sure.
I didn't.
Yeah.
So he made it retroactive and called it the Vietnam era GI Bill. And so I then, my then wife, my first wife, more or less suggested that I put up or shut up. In other words, I had a great gift of gab in that I was very comfortable telling people what I could be, what I might have been if it wasn't for the wife and two kids, you know, who held me back. Well, of course, I wanted them to hold me back
because
I was lazy. Yeah. I didn't want to excel or stick out my neck. So I welcomed the birth of both of my children because it relieved me of the responsibility of doing anything with my life. So then along comes the GI Bill, and that took away my excuse, you know. And so I thought, okay, I'll go apply, and I'll get refused. And well,
apply for school.
College,
yeah.
With the GED.
Right.
And so I applied at what was then the University of Chattanooga, but became the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga a couple of years later. And I remember being told by the registrar not to be too disappointed if I didn't make it to the second semester, because, as she said, they don't usually have very much luck with people like me. Now, I should say she wasn't being unkind. She was merely
stating facts.
She was just trying to, as you said, stating facts, and so I wouldn't get too disappointed. Well, I did very well. I made the dean's list 7 of the 8 semesters, and I worked full time.
What were you studying at that point?
I wasn't too sure at first, but I kind of started off at the bottom of a ladder that I created. And at the bottom of the ladder was simply my aspiration was to become, since I had not been a very successful salesman before, to get a sales job with a company that required a college education, meaning a little more dignified sales other than the door-to-door stuff that I was doing. And with a company car and an expense account. Okay, that was number one. Then when I saw that I was doing a little bit better than that, I thought, okay, pharmacy. Wear a white coat and make pills and things like that. So I was beginning to lean towards the health care industry. And I can only say because my parents, you know, they both died of cancer when I was 16. And so I guess I was unconsciously or subconsciously leaning towards the health industry. And I can remember as a salesman walking through the emergency room of the local hospital and just looking left and right at what was going on and becoming enthralled with the ER doc that was spinning his stethoscope around, you know, just like, you know, that was his release. And I thought, wow, I'd sure like to be that someday. But anyway, in college, I was thinking about these things. And then finally, I thought about dentistry because at the time, that didn't require any, or at least I didn't think it required any postgraduate training. But then I got to thinking, you know, standing there working in people's mouths all day long, that's not really what I want. But I had the right idea. I was leaning towards health. And I guess I was purposely avoiding medicine itself because I knew that that would be a horrendous obligation and commitment. And I remember I had a wife and two kids that needed somebody. and I'll never forget this. My pastor at the time, apparently I was having a conversation about the future, which I apparently did quite a bit with anybody who would listen. And he, I think he said something like, well, Joel, what is it you really want to be? And I don't know why. I won't say I took offense, but I thought it was kind of a facetious question, so I thought I'd give a facetious answer. And out of my mouth, with no warning whatsoever, I said, I want to be a doctor. And I thought, ooh, where did that come from? You know. And he said, well, you know, be one. And I said, no, no, no. And he said, why not? And I said, because I'm afraid of failure. In other words, I thought it better to be on the bottom and succeed than to extend oneself and fall. And he said, Joel, there's no sin in failure. The sin is in not trying. And I thought, oh boy, here we go, you know. And then it dawned on me that most medical schools had an age limit of 30. And by this time, I was pushing 32 already. So I thought, okay, I'll go ahead and apply, and I'll get turned down just because of my age. And
then, how far along were you in your baccalaureate?
When your conversation took place, you mean?
Yeah, were you at the 3 or 4 year mark, or did you have your bachelor's degree at that point?
Oh, no. I was still proceeding
towards
BA degree. These conversations were merely a progression from the day I entered college until finally.
Understood.
So the decision to go to medical school obviously had to be made before graduation.
Right.
Because there was no time gap in between there. So as that was the last decision that was made, when he said, you know, there's no sin in failure, the sin is in not trying. And I thought, well, you know, here we go. I might as well. I've gone this far. And I was getting very good grades, much to everyone's surprise, because after all, I was in my early 30s now and only had a GED and could barely read. And yet I was, you know.
Were you surprised at yourself?
Oh, yes, as was everyone else.
Yeah. But your confidence was there. I mean,
it wasn't in the beginning, but it was certainly
growing.
It was
building, sure.
And, you know, I think as I look back, there was an explanation for this, quite simply. My parents were very intelligent and they were college educated, so I apparently inherited some good genes, although they weren't around very long. You know, they died, as I said, when I was 16.
Sure.
So on the one hand, I think I inherited good genes, but did not have them to nurture me, or else I would have gone right on to college right out of high school, but
right.
I quit high school. So I think the genetics has a lot to do with what I was able to eventually achieve. And so I applied, fully expecting to be rejected on, for no other reason, just my age, because they stated age 30. Well, and I was 32 now. Lo and behold, the University of Tennessee accepted me, and so I had mixed emotions. On the one hand, I thought, oh, no, you know, 4, 8 more years?
Yeah.
And, I mean, my kids will be grown, you know. But on the other hand, I thought, wow, you know, janitor to doctor is not a bad jump. So I thought, hey, I've got to do it, at least try. And so I graduated in June and started in September medical school. And now that was difficult. I mean, that was extraordinarily difficult. The average day of study would, classes all day long till 3 or 4 in the afternoon. and then study until midnight, 1, 2 in the morning.
Yeah.
And on the night before a test, it would be no sleep at all. I mean, I would be up all night, fully dressed, and studying and drinking iced tea every 15 or 20 minutes.
How did you support yourself during that period?
Scholarships and loans. And,
yeah.
My wife didn't work. We made the deal that she would stay home. And
Was there any GI Bill left, or had you gone through that?
The GI Bill lasted for 4 or 5 months into medical school.
I see, okay.
But that's it.
Yeah.
So, but I had supported myself during undergraduate school.
Right.
I worked 40 hours a week.
Exactly.
So that was a cinch. So I kind of had the mistaken impression that, if I was that good in undergraduate school, and if I was able to work, how bad can medical school be?
Right.
Well, I found out. And it was a struggle, academically, emotionally, maritally, financially, you know, everything.
Everything was on the table.
And I reached a point where I said, you know, I don't care what happens. I've got to finish this, you know. Even if it means everything else falling apart, because when you've invested that much, now some people might have a hard time understanding that, but when you have nothing to look back on except being a janitor, and here you are about to have MD after your name, and you've been pushed, you know, this far, you might as well finish.
Sure.
And I recall there was several days between my final class and graduation day, and I was reluctant to even walk across a street for fear of getting run over, you know, killed, because
it was too good to be true at this
point. Well, before getting the degree.
Yeah.
You know, see what I mean?
Right.
I was afraid that, you know, I would be buried as, you know, a senior medical student.
Oh, right.
So I at least wanted to make it to the commencement exercises, which of course I did. And so anyway, it was a long struggle.
So you were then, what, 37 or 38?
Okay, at graduation, I was just a month short of 35.
Of 35, okay.
The University of Tennessee, unlike most other medical schools, went year-round. We had a couple of weeks off for Christmas, so actually the actual calendar time in medical school was 3 years and 9 months.
I see.
As opposed to four 9-month years.
Right.
3 years and 9 months. But I had... I met Danny Thomas, you know who he is?
Sure. If I knew who Danny Thomas was.
He was the founder of St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital, which was part of the medical center there in Memphis. So I had the privilege of meeting him during his annual visit to St. Jude's, which at which time he gives a pep talk to the staff and whatnot. And The meeting was significant or memorable in that it came at the close of his pep talk, and everyone else got up and left the room, and I noticed that he was still standing there with no entourage, no assistants. So I said, I'm going to walk up there and talk to him. So I walked up there, and at no time did he ever look over my shoulder for somebody to come rescue him or anything like that. He looked me right in the eye, and I ran out of things to say.
To chat about. Wow.
And, I mean, he was interested. I mean, he may not have been interested, but he was at least polite enough to never take his eyes off me.
Isn't that great?
He could have been looking over my shoulder for somebody to, you know, please come get me. Yeah.
Yeah.
He never did that, and I've never forgotten that. So, but that was in 72, I guess. I graduated in 73.
Uh-huh.
And from there, I went to Duke University Medical Center, where I learned to be a radiation oncologist and practiced from 78 through 96. And that was the end of the career.
Yeah. Wow. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Just wonderful. Were you in practice for yourself, or did you join a clinic?
No, I always was a solo practitioner. I don't know that I ever made that requirement in the beginning, but I just seemed to enjoy being the boss and making my own decisions. And it seemed to me, and I know I'm probably wrong about saying this, but it just seemed to me that most doctors who worked in groups with other doctors, they seem to have to bounce everything off of partners and whatnot. And there's nothing wrong with that, I guess. But I just, I guess it goes back to being impulsive in that I made decisions. I made them on the spot. Most of the time they were right, like the decision to quit high school because my driver's license was taken away, the decision to quit the FAA. I mean, I had an excellent future with the FAA there in San Francisco, but I quit because they wouldn't transfer me to Tennessee. And the decision to start school, you know. But I did everything usually without a whole lot of consultation with other people, and so I just felt more comfortable making my own decisions. But again, I mean no disrespect for doctors who do practice in groups, but it was just for me, it was best to practice solo.
Well, how did you then ultimately end up in Nassau County, which is where we are now?
Yeah, that was a pretty simple decision. When I did retire from active practice, the considerations were all family. In other words, my kids, who are now grown and married and with children, and my in-laws, where they lived. And so my kids lived in South Florida, and my in-laws lived in North Carolina. So we wanted to be halfway between them. Well, the halfway point actually would have been up somewhere in Georgia, somewhere. But Georgia charges income tax, and Florida doesn't. So we actually started the North Florida search around St. Augustine, I think. Felt that was too touristy. And then Jacksonville Beach and Jacksonville, that was just too crowded. And we came across Fernandina Beach, and I had heard of Amelia Island simply because it was where the tennis star Chris Evert got her start. And not that that meant anything to me, but that's how I had heard of it. And we looked, and actually we're not that impressed at first, simply because the prices, the houses that were affordable to us weren't all that nice, I thought, and those that were nice were a little bit out of our range.
Sure.
So we were on our way off the island, and we happened to look over our shoulder. It was almost sundown. And I can't really describe to you where we were, but it was on the First Coast Highway, say between town and the plantation. And looking off to the left, we could see the sun going down behind the marsh. And that property is all built up now, but it was only one or two houses. And we pulled over there and stopped, got out, and we said, wow, you know, this is beautiful. Let's spend one more day here. And we did, and we saw some real estate agents, and we bought a condo on the plantation. We have since moved off of the plantation, but that snagged us. You might
that was
say.
It.
The
great
sundown there, and again, it conformed to a family needs, being halfway between kids and in-laws. So we're happy. We've been here since 97.
Great.
I'm sorry. Yeah, 96. I retired on the last day of 96. I still work about 10 or 12 weeks a year doing what's called locum tenens work. That means I cover for vacationing radiation oncologists in seven states. I have seven state licenses now.
Good for you. That's
so
great.
I travel, and I work as if, when, and where I feel like it.
Sure.
And the rest of the time I volunteer. I volunteer here and at ARC, the Association for Retarded Citizens.
Yes.
I've done other volunteer work in the past. I usually get, look to change volunteer opportunities every 3 or 4 years. But right now, these are the two that I'm involved with.
Well, that's great. Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you, Joel, Dr. Carter, that whole story to me is just fascinating. It's wonderful about going in under not the best of conditions with your family situation and serving honorably, serving well, learning a skill, a very important profession, learning to fly, no less, and then having the gumption and the willingness to struggle and work hard to become a full-fledged medical doctor. Mm-hmm. I think that's a wonderful, wonderful story. And the service to your country, both in the military and in the medical profession, you know, will be remembered for a long time to come. And I'm very grateful you've taken the time to join us for this Veterans History Project interview. Is there anything else you'd like to add, sir, before we close it out, do you think?
Well, you had mentioned previously that there would be some interest in how did the Air Force prepare me. Actually, they did two things. Of course, they prepared me for my initial post-military career, that being air traffic control. And I think beyond that, the military enabled me to strive. And we're talking about a person here who wasn't prone to strive, okay? But the military enabled me to strive beyond what I perceived as my own limits in achieving medicine. Because medicine, I mean, really was way beyond me.
Wow.
Way.
Yes,
I could
sir.
Barely read, you know. But the military, the discipline and the way they taught us, I think was eventually responsible for me achieving the medical career, because I'm certain that I would not have without that.
That's great. Well, we thank you, Dr. Carter, for sharing your reflections, your recollections with the museum for the benefit of our nation. And this concludes the interview with Dr. Joel Carter. Thank you, Dr. Carter. Mm-hmm.